I'm Jishan Singh, and after a short break, you are welcome to Dr. Stephen Hawking, The Brief History of Time. Episode 19, The Origin and Fate of the Universe, Part 3. Talking about some models, some inflationary models about the universe and how the universe works in previous episode. In today's episode, we are going to see that how we can unify both quantum physics and general relativity to find a unified theory that can describe the whole universe. In order to predict how the universe should have started off, one needs laws that hold at the beginning of time. If the classical theory of general relativity was correct, the singularity theorems that Roger Penrose and Hawking proved showed that the beginning of time would have been a point of infinite density and infinite curvature of space-time. All the known laws of science would break down at such a point. One might suppose that there was new laws that held at singularity. But it would be very difficult even to formulate such laws at such badly behaved points, and we would have no guide from observations as to what those laws might be. However, what the singularity theorems really indicate is that the gravitational field becomes so strong that quantum gravitational effects become important. Classical theory is no longer a good description of the universe, so one has to use quantum theory of gravity to discuss the very early stage of universe. As we shall see, it is possible in the quantum theory of the ordinary laws of science to hold everywhere, including at the beginning of time. It is not necessary to postulate new laws for singularities because there need not be any singularities in the quantum theory. We don't yet have a complete and consistent theory that combines quantum mechanics and gravity. However, we are fairly certain of such features that such a unified theory should have. One is that it should incorporate Feynman's proposal to formulate quantum theory in terms of a sum over histories. In this approach, a particle does not have just a single history as it would in a classical theory. Instead, it is supposed to follow every possible path in space-time, and which each of these histories there are associated a couple of numbers, one representing the size of a wave and the other representing its position in the cycle. The probability that the particle, say, passes through some particular point is found by adding up the ways associated with every possible history that passes through that point. When one actually tries to perform these sums, however, one runs into severe technical problems. The only way around these is the following peculiar prescriptions. One must add up the ways for particle histories that are not in the real time that you and I experience but take place in what is called imaginary time. Imaginary time may sound like science fiction, but it is in fact a well-defined mathematical concept. If we take any ordinary number and multiply it by itself, the result is a positive number. For example, 2 times 2 is 4, but so is minus 2 times minus 2. There are, however, such special numbers called imaginary numbers that give negative numbers when multiplied by themselves. The one is called iota. When multiplied by itself, gives minus 1. 2 iota multiplied by itself gives minus 4, and so on. One can picture real and imaginary numbers in the following ways. The real numbers can be represented by a line going from left to right with 0 in the middle, negative numbers like minus 1, minus 2, etc. on the left, and positive numbers like 1, 2, etc. on right. Then imaginary numbers are represented by a line going up and down the page with iota, 2 iota, etc. above the middle, and minus iota, minus 2 iota, etc. below. Thus, imaginary numbers are in a sense numbers at right angle to ordinary real numbers. To avoid the technical difficulties with Feynman's sum over histories, one must use imaginary time. That is to say, for the purposes of the calculation, one must measure time using imaginary numbers rather than real ones. This has an interesting effect on space-time. The distinctions between space and time disappears completely. A space-time in which events have imaginary values of the time coordinate is said to be Euclidean, after the ancient Greek Euclid, who founded the study of geometry of two-dimensional surfaces. What we now called Euclidean space-time is very similar, except that it has four dimensions instead of two. In Euclidean space-time, there is no difference between the time direction and direction in space. On the other hand, in real space-time, in which events are labeled by ordinary real values of the time coordinates, it is easy to tell the difference. The time direction at all points lies within the light cone, and space direction lies outside. In any case, as far as everyday quantum mechanics is concerned, we may regard our use of imaginary time and Euclidean space-time as merely a mathematical device to calculate answers about real space-time. A second feature that we believe must be part of any unlimited theory is Einstein's idea that the gravitational field is represented by curved space-time. Particles try to follow the nearest thing to a straight path in a curved space, but because space-time is not flat, their path appears to be bent as if a gravitational field. When we apply Feynman's sum over histories to Einstein's view of gravity, the analog of the history of a particle is now a complete curved space-time that represents the history of the whole universe. To avoid the technical difficulties in actually performing the sum over histories, these curved space-times must be taken to be Euclidean. That is, time is imaginary and is indistinguishable from directions in space. To calculate the probability of finding a real space-time with some certain property, such as looking the same at every point in every direction, one adds up the waves associated with all the histories that have that property. In the classical theory of general relativity, there are many different possible curved space-times, each corresponding to a different initial state of the universe. If we knew the initial state of our universe, we would know its entire history. Similarly, in the quantum theory of gravity, there are many different possible quantum states for the universe. Again, if we knew how the Euclidean curved space-times in the sum over histories behaved at early times, we would know the quantum state of the universe. In the classical theory of gravity, which is based on real space-time, there are only two possible ways the universe can behave. Either it has existed for any infinite time, or else it had a beginning at a singularity at some finite time in the past. In the quantum theory of gravity, on the other hand, a third possibility arises. Because one is using Euclidean space-times, in which the time direction is on the same footing as directions in space, it is possible for space-time to be finite in extent and yet to have no singularities that formed a boundary or edge. Space-time would be like the surface of Earth, only with two more dimensions. The surface of the Earth is finite in extent, but it doesn't have a boundary or edge. If you sail off into the sunset, you don't fall off the edge or run into a singularity. If Euclidean space-time stretches back to infinite imaginary time, or else start at a singularity in imaginary time, we have the same problem as in the classical theory of specifying the initial state of the universe. God may know how the universe began, but we cannot give any particular reason for thinking it began one way rather than another. On the other hand, the quantum theory of gravity has opened up a new possibility, in which there would be no boundary to space-time, and so there would be no need to specify the behavior at the boundary. There would be no singularity at which the laws of science broke down, and no edge of the space-time at which one would have to appeal to God or some new law to set the boundary conditions for space-time. One could say the boundary conditions of the universe is that it has no boundary. The universe would be completely self-contained and not affected by anything outside itself. It wouldn't neither be created nor be destroyed. It would just be. Here, Hawking adds, I had like to emphasize that this idea that space and time should be finite that is without boundary is just a proposal. It cannot be deduced from some other principle. Like any other scientific theory, it may initially be put forward for aesthetic or metaphysical reasons, but the real test is whether it makes predictions that agree with the observations. This, however, is difficult to determine in the case of quantum gravity for two reasons. First, as we explained in before chapter, we are not sure exactly which theory successfully combines general relativity and quantum mechanics, though we know quite a lot about the form such a theory must have. Second, any model that describes the whole universe in detail would be much too complicated mathematically for us to be able to calculate exact predictions. One, therefore, has to make simplified assumptions and approximations, and even then, the problem of extracting predictions remains a formidable one. Each history in the sum over histories will describe not only the space-time but everything in it as well, including any complicated organism like human beings who can observe the history of the universe. This may provide another justification for the anthropic principle, for if all the histories are possible, then so long as we exist in one of the history, we may use the anthropic principle to explain why the universe is found to be the way it is. Exactly what means can be attracted to the other histories in which we do not exist in is not clear. This view of a quantum theory of gravity would be much more satisfactory. However, if one could show that using the sum over histories, our universe is not just one of the possible histories, but one of the most probable ones. To do this, we must perform the sum over histories for all possible Euclidean spacetimes that have no boundary. Under the no boundary proposal, one learns that the chance of the universe being found to be following most of the possible histories is negligible, but there is a particular family of histories that are much more probable than the others. These histories may be pictured as being like the surface of Earth, with the distance from the North Pole representing imaginary time and the size of the circle of constant distance from North Pole representing the spatial size of the universe. The universe starts at the North Pole as a single point. As one moves south, the circle of latitude at constant distance from the North Pole gets bigger, corresponding to the universe expanding with imaginary time. The universe would reach a maximum size at the equator and would contract with increasing imaginary time to a single point at the South Pole. Even though the universe would have zero size at the North and South Poles, these points would not be singularities any more than the North 8 South Poles on the Earth are singular. The laws of science will hold at them just as they do at the North and South Poles on the Earth. The history of the universe in real time, however, would look very different. At about 10 or 20,000 million years ago, it would have a minimum size, which was equal to the maximum radius of the history in imaginary time. At later real times, the universe would expand like the chaotic inflationary model proposed by Lind, but one would not now have to assume that the universe was created somehow in the right sort of the state. The universe would expand to a very large size and eventually it would collapse again into what looked like a singularity in real time. Thus, in a sense, we are still all doomed, even if we keep away from the black holes. Only if we could picture the universe in terms of imaginary time would there be no singularities. If the universe really is in such a quantum state, there would be no singularity in the history of the universe in imaginary time. But as indicated above, the real importance of singularity theorems was that they showed that the gravitational field must become so strong that quantum gravitational effects could not be ignored. This in turn led to the idea that the universe could be finite in imaginary time, but without boundaries or singularities. When one goes back to a real time in which we live, however, there will still appear to be singularity. The poor astronaut will fall into a black hole, will still come to a sticky end. Only if he lived in imaginary time would he encounter no singularity. This might suggest that the so-called imaginary time is really the real time, and that we call real time is just a figment of our imagination. In real time, the universe has a beginning and an end at the singularity that form a boundary to space-time and at which the laws of science break down. But in imaginary time, there are no singularities or boundaries. So maybe we call imaginary time is really more basic, and what we call real is just an idea that we invent to help us describe what we think the universe is like. So it is meaningless to ask which is real, real or imaginary time. It is simply a matter of which is the most useful description. One can also use the sum over histories along with the no boundary proposal to find which property of the universe are likely to occur together. For example, one can calculate the probability that the universe is expanding at nearly the same rate at all different directions at a time when the density of the universe has its present value. In the simplified models that has been examined so far, this probability turned out to be high. That is, the proposed no boundary conditions lead to the prediction that it is extremely probable that the present rate of the expansion of the universe is almost the same in each direction. It is consistent with the observation of the microwave background radiation, which show that it has almost exactly the same intensity in any direction. If the universe were expanding faster in some direction than in another, the intensity of the radiation in those directions would be reduced by any additional red shift. The idea that space and time may form a closed surface without boundary also have profound implications for the role of God in the affairs of the universe. With the success of scientific theories in describing events, most people have come to believe that God allows the universe to evolve according to a set of laws and does not intervene in the universe to break these laws. However, the laws do not tell us what the universe should have looked like when it started. It would still be up to God to wind up the clockwork and choose how to start it off. So long as the universe had a beginning, we could suppose it had a creator. But if the universe is really completely self-contained, have no boundary or edges, it would have neither beginning nor end. It would simply be. What place, then, for a creator? So, lot of secrets are yet to be unfolded. We are way far from knowing the real occurrence of the universe. That's it for this episode. And I shall meet you in another episode with another interesting chapter, The Arrow of Time. So if you like the podcast, please subscribe it or follow it in whatever platform you are listening to it. And share it with your friends and family so they can also hear to it. And please send your reviews regarding the improvement and regarding what you think about this podcast. Keep supporting. Thank you. Thank you.